Shopping Maniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show podcast, all about front end web design and development. I'm Dave. Everything I see confirms that I am actually correct, Rupert, and with me is Chris.
I'm going to project this upon you, Coyer.
Okay, good. Yeah. How are you projecting today, Chris? Anyway.
Well, I'm kind of just thinking that my future self is just basically me with nicer shoes. So he's probably wants That's all good. The same things that I want. We have a special guest on today, and it's a big week for him. So we have David Dillard Thomas on. Hey, Dave, how you doing?
Hey, yeah, this is Dave Zero Risk Bias Thomas.
Okay. Everyone gets their favorite bias in their, as a nickname. And
You know what made me sad about learning about this stuff a little bit? And for our listeners, congratulations, Dave. You've just released a brand new book on A Book Apart all about cognitive bias. So go pick it up. Design for Cognitive Bias as well. So there's, you know, connections to all this digital work that we all do. You know, my least favorite part about learning about this stuff, though, is it's fun to learn about all the biases. In fact, there's so many. It's actually kind of a fun thing to just dig into a little bit, because each one is its own little fun little journey. But that once you know about them, it doesn't matter.
That's the most depressing part. Because I watched this amazing talk by Irrespondent called Gender Equality by Design, and it kind of led me on this path of trying to learn about every single cognitive bias I could. Mm-hmm. And about a month in, it became very clear. Like, I would go to like a Wikipedia page about some bias, and I'd be looking for the part where it's like, okay, and here's how you fight that bias. I never found it. There was like, there's maybe three biases I found where there was even a little bit of, oh, scientists have used this technique to combat it. But otherwise, it's just sort of like, there it is. Good night.
Have you recognized it in yourself too? Like that?
Oh,
that
all the time. I mean, I picked zero risk bias because that is the one I think I suffer from the most. Because that's basically the bias where like you can have an experiment where you say, hey, we're going to do an experiment and there's like a 10% chance you'll receive a mild electric shock. But if you pay us $5, it'll only be a 5% chance. But if you pay us like $50, it'll be a 0.1% chance, and people will pay the $50, even though it's only a reduction of like 0.4, like 4.whatever%, because we love the idea of not having to think about things. So I totally fall into that trap.
Wow. That's sort of the throw money at things bias. Yeah. Throw money at problems bias,
yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah, there is that too. I think we don't have a scientific name for it, but yes, there's absolutely. Actually, no, we do. It's called capitalism. What am I talking about?
Oh, see, it reminds me of this thing in this video game that I play where it's like, if you can have like flares on a weapon that you're using in combat, and it's like there's 4% chance of flares, but you can pay millions and millions of coins in this game to get like 6% flares, and people just line up around the block to do it, you know. Kind of funny.
Yeah, I play Minecraft with my son, so I'm very keenly aware of there is a 2% chance that this thing will drop a special bow.
Yeah. Yeah,
drops are the best. Okay, so and if people didn't know as well, you've for quite a long time ran the Cognitive Bias podcast, which is just a gem, and I'm so glad you've done that. That will kind of last forever as these little digestible bits of, if you're interested in these type of biases, you can go, and they're just these little bite-sized episodes, which we've never been able to pull off here on Chop Talk Show. We deliver these huge long things. These are just like
2-hour ramble-a-thons. Yeah. We're more that format. You're more the read books and do succinct analyses. We're not that.
The reason they're so short, it's the only way I could guarantee I'd actually get one out a week. I made a deal with myself early on. So I said before, I was like studying all these biases, and I turned into the guy who wouldn't shut up about cognitive bias. So my friends were like, Dave, please just get a podcast. So one Friday, this is a time when I had Fridays off. So one Friday I sat down and I just said, okay, you know what? I'm just going to try this. And I turned on GarageBand. I pulled out a mic and I'm like, okay, this is the Cognitive Bias podcast. Like, I literally came up with the name during the recording of the first episode. And then I picked one bias and I had a few show notes about it. And I went through it. And I'm like, oh, that only took like 5-10 minutes. I can do this.
That's awesome.
Did it the next Friday. That's great.
Pretty much. I did it for years to come too. So I applaud you for that. Can we have some fun with these biases? Do you want to do some? Because I know that, you know, even the book starts with some ones that are harmless, and then you intentionally spend most of the book talking about the ones that are harmful, because those are a little more, I don't know, they're a little more important, perhaps.
Marginally.
But let's I don't know, pull a few out of a hat. Let's do this.
Sure. So the one I always like to start with is called Illusion of Control. And it's where if you have a game where you have to roll a die and you need a high number, you tend to throw the die really hard. But if you need a lower number, you tend to roll it really gently. And if you think about it for 2 seconds, obviously it makes zero difference, like how hard you throw the die. But we like to think we have control in situations where we have no control. And so we embody that by how hard we roll the die. And I love that one because it's so relatable. And so like no harm intended, but you get, okay, we're pretty stupid.
Because the person throwing those dice aren't even, they're probably not being like, I know this is silly, but I'm going to do it anyway. They don't even, that doesn't even register. They just do it, right? Yeah.
You know where I do this? It, the hard refresh, like for my browser. Oh, I hit those.
Yeah.
Like the shift key.
Keys real hard.
It's like, you got to let the computer you mean it.
Yeah. And that's going to make the cache clear better because I'm going to hit it real hard.
I know. It's like hitting the walk signal 30 times.
Yeah. Or elevators back when we could use those elevators where you like hit the close the door button over and over and it doesn't really do anything.
It's just a placebo button, right? So, oh man. This is getting me.
We did Illusion of Control. That's a wonderful one. We did Zero Risk. A classic is like Confirmation Bias, which is that's a scary one, right? Because we're in election season all this, and
we are living Confirmation Bias. 2020 is Confirmation Bias incarnate.
And you can be really aware of this one, and actually, to me, I almost wear it like a blanket. Sometimes I'm like, no, I don't. Sorry, listeners, I don't listen to Fox News because it makes me upset. So I just don't. You know, I'm gonna put my little Confirmation Bias blanket on and.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing about, especially in an election year, like, because I, in an election year, confirmation bias kind of teams up with in-group, out-group bias to make this big bias monster. And for me, you know, I'm a liberal, I'm a Democrat, and I feel very secure in my beliefs and my, like, whatever. And so, like, the only way I can check myself is to occasionally ask myself, okay, do I agree with anything Trump has done at all? Right. And so I'll hear something like, he wants to extend the ban on evictions. I'm like, okay, that I actually agree with that. Great. Okay. I'm not a total, you know, narrow-minded person in this, you know, but you look for, but you have to ask yourself, if I'm wrong, what else would be true? So if Trump's not an asshole, what else would be true? If I can find that and prove it, then great. If not, which frankly, usually I can't, then I'm like, okay, maybe I'm still like not totally making this all up for my own benefit.
So to check your like groundedness on your belief, I mean, somebody can equally be like, I don't like Hillary for whatever reason or something, but you could, your like the way you ground yourself is like, you said it, but I forgot.
Oh, sure. You basically say, if I'm wrong, right?
If I'm wrong.
Right. If gun control is a bad idea, right? For example, if I'm convinced that gun control is a good idea, if it's a bad idea, what else would be true? I'd ponder on that and say, okay, well, let me see if I can prove that. And it's a way to actively disprove what you believe rather than actively prove what you believe, which is what most of us do.
We're always in a state. Yeah. We're in a state of always proving ourselves with every, you know, I read on the internet. You know, some anonymous post blogger told me, the thing I believe. So
some of them are hard to, sometimes concepts are too big for me to even start, though. Because like if it's capitalism is bad, that one's a tough one for me. Because I feel like I live in a bubble where that's repeated to me a lot. I see that one a lot and I don't get it because I'm like, I don't really understand what the alternative is. And just because I've lived my whole life this way and I feel like I'm this kind of guy who's always looking to make his next buck too, you know, like having entrepreneurial ideas. I'm like, don't I like capitalism or am I just not, you know, and then I don't even know where to start unconfirming my.
And I think that with that, there's a certain set of biases that really have to do with context and how hard it is for us like to see the water we're swimming in. Like if you're a fish, it's really hard to explain the concept of water, you know, yeah. much less to say, oh, sometimes water is bad. Like it's a really hard, you know, thing to get around.
Yeah.
So there's things like system justification bias where like no matter how bad a system is treating you, or it just is like, it's much easier to live in a world where like everything works than to live in a world where things are broken. And so basically if it's easier to process, hey, everything's fine, like we'll just defer to that. Like that will be the bias we confirm. Whereas thinking contextually about the bigger picture is we're not usually trained to do it. And it's interesting. Like one of the things I looked at when I was looking at all these biases are, is there any cultural difference, right? Are these biases universal? Any country you go to, you're going to see it.
Oh, interesting.
And for the most part, they are, except the set of biases that have to do with, are you good at looking at context? So there's one bias called fundamental attribution error, where if I see somebody else run a red light, I'm going to think, oh, that guy, oh, come on now, right? Like that guy's a terrible driver. He's impatient. Whereas if I run a red light, I'm like, oh, I was late. Right. Mm. So for me, I look at the context, look at the bigger picture. For that other guy, I'm like, well, he must be terrible. I'm not even going to consider the possibility that he was late for work. So in Western cultures, like that bias is rampant, right? We're not good at looking at the context. We're individualistic. We think about ourselves. In cultures where you're kind of that are more collectivist, where you're more used to thinking about the greater good in other people. So some Asian cultures are like this. You tend to see a little less. And there's this great experiment where you have someone look at a digital aquarium, kind of like the Netflix screensaver. And you ask them afterwards, like, just write down everything you can remember. And for more individualistic people from more individualistic cultures, they're great at remembering the fish, right? They can describe the fish really well. For people who come from more collectivist cultures, they can describe the fish, they can describe the color of the water, they can describe like the background and all the little ferns and plants, and all the little holes and the little thing, you know, like they're much better at looking at the whole picture because their whole life they've been raised to think about, you need to think about the collective, you need to think about the big picture, you need to think about the context. So all of that to say, like if we're bad at thinking about capitalism or systemic injustice or any of those things, it's because we're bad at thinking about systems, period.
Yeah.
We just care about how it benefits us. I mean,
what's in the foreground. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, and not like Chris, you're like, I have an entrepreneurial spirit and I probably share some of that as well. But you know, you're like, capitalism is benefiting me. Seems like it's okay. You know, and not that like not calling you out or anything. I think that's just the nature of it, or, you know, just there's so much you, and this sort of gets in the question I had reading your book, like, you know, 95% of our brain is automatic. I think you said sort of the lizard brain just working. How do we like deprogram it or get around it? That sort of was my question, because it just, there's so many of these biases just kind of go. They're just automatic, right?
Yeah. And I think about it very much like an alcoholic thinks about not going into a bar, right? The alcoholic knows they are an alcoholic. This is a disease. This is this thing that they have. It is part of them now. They can't snap their fingers and make it go away. And so they create these guardrails in their lives so that that thing they have causes as little harm as possible. And that's the way I think about bias. Like in a very long game, you might have particular tendencies that you can start to curb over time. But for the most part, you know, as you say, like this is happening below the threshold of conscious thought. You don't even realize you're doing it. So knowing that, you create these guardrails. So for example, one of the things I talk about is anonymized resumes, right? And it's this idea that if you have two identical resumes and one of them has, and the only difference is the name at the top, if it's a female sounding name, it tends to not advance. If it's a male sounding name, it tends to advance. And it's not because every hiring manager is explicitly a chauvinist. And if you ask them, hey, do you think men are better at this job? They'd say yes. Most of them would say no, but they still exhibit the behavior, because the behavior is happening at the subconscious level. So what you do is you say, okay, maybe I just don't show you the name. Because frankly, the name isn't actually helping you pick who's a better web designer. Like that has no bearing. So it's not relevant.
Yeah.
Right. So knowing that you have this tendency, I'm going to remove a design element to create a less biased process, right? That's me saying, hey, I'm going to make sure that I'm going to lock all the bar doors for you because you're an alcoholic. So that's how I tend to think about, like, yeah, you've got this thing that I look down the page and there's no cure for, or no short-term cure for. How can I use design to say, okay, let me make sure that that tendency you have causes the least harm possible?
I've seen companies actually do this too. It's not just theoretical. I worked with a company last year that, and by worked with, I meant I have a job board on CodePen and they wanted to run a bunch of jobs on it as different tests. And they were telling me all about their hiring process, and they did the no names thing to eliminate their own biases. So it's a thing you can do. I guess it's a little bit more complicated of a process because somebody like accidentally looks at those names probably as they're coming in, and then that person needs to then remove the name and pass them to the next person probably, but certainly doable.
Yeah, and if you think about it, I mean, this is why I kind of married design with this. I mean, part of it is just that's my background. I'm a UX practitioner, content strategist. And so that's the head I'm bringing to looking at bias. But like when I think about it, it's like, okay, it's not just blanking the resume as it comes in. Like that's the really short-term solution. The somewhat longer-term solution is to say, okay, when you're filling out this job application, I'm just not going to ask you for your name. You know, I'm going to assign you an identity based on the order it came in so that I have a unique identifier for you. It's like from a design standpoint, from a code standpoint, these are solved problems. Like I know how to gather data in a way that is anonymized. Like we've known how to do that for a very long time. It's just, we've never thought of applying that to resumes because we're used to thinking of resumes as I'm going to sit down and have coffee with you and I'll get a vibe and then I'll know whether I want you in my company, right? Like that's how we really think about hiring. So the idea of thinking, and we don't think about all the biases that are inherent to that whole scenario. So if we think about hiring as more just like scientifically, not to make it totally cold, but as like, okay, what are all the, because a scientist is always looking for opportunities for bias to come in and ruin their experiments. If we think about it that way, it's like, oh, right. If I know what college you went to, mere, you know, familiarity or mere exposure effect is going to make me like you better than someone who went to a college I've never heard of, but they might actually be better at their job.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Like, thinking of it more of a scientific process, you're just trying to root out any kind of variable that would impact the, I guess, the test.
Wow. I like the thinking of science as a way of, like, they're actively trying to fight these biases so their science will be better.
I mean, that's why the scientific method was invented. It was because literally confirmation bias. Like, they're realizing that we aren't going to get reliable data, right, or reliable results that are going to help us, you know, in the field, or that are going to help us actually build new things. if these things are biased, like you're going to get out in the field and find out, you know, your fire extinguisher doesn't work. You don't want that.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by Framer. That's framer.com/shoptalk. Go there, sign up for free, get 20% off any paid plan. That's very generous. Thank you, Framer. When you've spent hours designing something beautiful for the web, the last thing you want to hear is, oh, sorry, we can't build this, you know? What you need is a tool that bridges the gap between design and development. Framer can be that bridge. It's a browser-based prototyping tool that enables designers to use code-backed components and dynamic transitions to visually express ideas. So when the time comes that, you know, you perhaps as the designer are giving it to a developer, the developer can jump in and easily inspect the elements, get the CSS or the JSX right from there. Custom animations, custom built with Magic Motion. It's powered by Framer Motion, which is an open source library that's awesome. You should check out for React. It all comes with a complete clean code, which can be taken right from Framer and you can move it right into production. So it's the gap. It's the Framer is the bridge. So sign up for free or get 20% off any paid plan by visiting framer.com/shoptalk. That's framer.com/shoptalk.
So are like popular ideas like culture fit, quote unquote, hands, is that sort of, I guess, like a bias factory? Is that sort of like just bad news?
I mean, that's just in-group bias, right? That's just a fancy word for we like the way we are and we don't want to grow. I used to sort of like think about that a lot. Like I used to buy into, I mean, it's very comfortable. It's like a comfortable shoe, like the notion of, oh, I'm going to have coffee with you and we'll vibe. Right. And I'll figure out like, mm-hmm. If you're like us. But from another lens, that's like super monoculture. Like even if it's a good culture, even if it's like, I like hanging out with these people, that's still a very, like fixed mindset versus growth mindset. And what I love is, I forget who said this, but someone was saying, don't look for culture fit, look for someone who's going to make your culture grow. Right. Like to me, the new hotness isn't, oh, we're going to like be more diverse and you're going to come into my company, person of color or woman, and fit in now. And we're going to change whatever unique things you bring to the table so that you're like us, you know, which is you see a lot of times when people try diversity initiatives, people will come in and 6 months later they leave because they didn't feel welcome. Like to me, the new hotness is saying, okay, we're going to bring you in specifically because you're different from us. And not different in a way that we think is going to make our culture worse, but in a way that we think is going to make our culture better, because we see our culture as something that is evolving constantly rather than this one fixed, you know, perfect little diamond that we can't touch.
Mm. Yeah, that's great. Like you just don't create a bunch of replicants. Like, you know, I don't know. It's not a Borg. It's a company.
Well, I think of it like the Avengers. Like, why would you form a team like the Avengers and then have them all be Iron Man? Like, what's the point?
Oh, that's the best.
Right?
What a good example.
Because Iron Man 3 was not a great movie. But
don't start. I will fight you point by point because I'm a Shane. Because I'm a Shane Black fan.
Okay.
Right? So it's gonna turn into a whole thing.
Okay. Well, I can't. Was there a fanaticism bias? Let me check.
Oh yeah. Like, my movie going is highly biased.
Is there like a cyclical bias? Is there a bias where you think you're above bias?
Oh, there's a bias blind spot. It's one of the first ones I did on the podcast. And it's basically the idea that you think you don't have any biases, but you're sure that everybody else does.
Yeah. Is that the, I don't see race.
Oh yeah. Like, yeah.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Just, I transcend it. It's easy.
I think even if you don't think you're one of those people, that you might think they exist too, that you might, that if somebody's you know, just this really like transcendent character in whatever industry you happen to be in, that's like, look at how rich and successful they are and how eloquent they are. Oh my God, they must just live on another. They're so smart. The way they think is so evolved. They must be totally above biases, you know?
I don't know that there's a word for this, but there's definitely like a myth, an entrepreneur myth that we have in this country around folks like Steve Jobs or Michael Bloomberg or Warren Buffett or whoever, where it's like, part of it is the capitalism thing of equating riches with virtue. Like if you're rich, and this is like, I don't even want to say capitalist, it's like it's Puritan. Like if you're rich, it must be because you were smart enough and bold enough and brave enough to do that. Like your wealth is an indicator of virtue. Actually, there was a word for this. It's called halo effect. If you're rich, you must also be smart. You must also be kind. You must also be, you know, fancy and all these other things. Like there's no such thing as being rich and evil, right? Like it must all go together perfectly.
And that's like some theism mixed in.
Oh, there, absolutely.
Probably, huh? Like,
absolutely.
Like, I mean, I could think, you know, back in Bible times or whatever, it's like, well, they're rich. God must like them or whatever, you know? And so, yeah, I think it's just a very big loaded idea, right?
I'm going to be the rich guy with mustard on his shirt, though, so I'm going to tear down that wall.
Yeah, please go in and ruin that myth for us. But the other piece, going back to like the collectivist individuals thing, is also the notion of the self-made man, right? And this notion that like if you're smart in America, you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps, which is physically impossible, by the way. You can pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, and without anyone's help, and without any degree of luck, become who you are, right? And so like when people, I got asked a little while ago for an article, like to what do I credit, you know, my success? And I was very careful about how I answered that, because at that point in my life, I was hyper aware of that myth. And so I sort of credited, I think what I said was persistence and luck. And the persistence part was, like, I did very much. I mean, like I said, I looked up literally every single bias on this one Wikipedia page, like day by day for a year, and then did 100 episodes of a podcast. So there's definitely some persistence involved there. But the fact that I had access to the internet, the fact that, you know, I was born to a woman who, like, stressed education, was willing to go into debt to send me to a good school, the fact that I was born in a country that at a certain level of, and at a time when a black man could do certain things, right, that I met the people I did, that people assisted me, that I had access to the technology I did to even do the podcast, right? Like, there's so many factors that I didn't really control. The fact that I'm a man, right?
Yeah.
And was taken more seriously than a woman would have been in certain situations. Like, all of those things I had no control over. So I like to give luck its due. It's because I want the narrative to include that, so that we start to dismantle a bit the myth of, no matter what the system says, no matter what the circumstances are, if you yourself are virtuous and true, everything will work out for you.
You know, when I first, you know, this is necessarily about this. We have some more biases we have to get into, but I like that you said that, because you think of, I don't know, when I first heard the word privilege, that seemed like a weird one. It takes a minute to wrap your head around that one. As I'm like, I don't feel privileged. Nah, that's like your that's like the required first response to that. Like, I've had hard times too. But then I look back at my life and I'm like, because you get this too when interviewers always ask you that. Anybody wants to know, where'd you come from? How'd you get to where you are? And you're like, reflecting back upon my history, I was like, you know what? I have faced no difficulty ever, comparatively, you know? It's not like everything was handed to me, but at the same time, it kind of was. Like, I don't think in my whole life I've ever faced like a real bad door slamming in my face ever. I only ever get, oh, come on, welcome, come, you know, learn, do good, be it. I don't know if that has anything to do with bias, but it reflectively, it's interesting.
Yeah, and it's you know, bias at the end of the day is very often a set of patterns that you just keep living out because they're easy to process, right? And so from your point of view, from the trick with privilege is that if you have it, you can't see it. Like, it is self-effacing by nature. Like, you know, the greatest trick the devil ever pulled was proving it didn't, you know, convincing the world didn't exist. The greatest trick privilege ever pulls is convincing you don't have it. Right? So from your perspective, like, it is very difficult to see. And everyone knows what it feels like to be rejected, but the circumstances around that rejection are relative. Like the metaphor I always love is, like, privilege is like playing life on the easiest difficulty setting. Like, it's not that it's not difficult. It's just that if you were to crank that up a couple of bars, you'd be like, how does anyone win this game?
Yeah. That's great. Should we do a few more? There's some other things to talk about, but these are just great. Every one of them unlocks interesting doors in your mind, doesn't it? I've listened to so many of these little podcast chunks. I'm trying to pick of how about the gamblers one? We already talked about gambling a little bit. Yeah.
So there's a whole, I did a whole, I think season two is all about probability and how bad we are at thinking about probability. And I can attest to this. I took probability in college thinking it would be really easy because everyone thinks they understand chance and how numbers work, you know, and it's...
Well, there's a bias right there. Then.
Yeah, exactly. It's a little Dunning-Kruger going on there. But in fact, oh my God, probability is so hard. And we are so bad at thinking about it. And, like, there's a gambler's ruin and a whole old sort of, like, biases around that are... It's this notion of, like, when people are gambling and there's like a team that's doing terribly, you start to think, oh, well, they're due. Like, there's a great joke on The Simpsons where Krusty the Clown loses all his money betting against the Harlem Globetrotters because he says the generals were due. Like, like, you know, but if you see someone, like, lose over and over and over and over again, you're like, oh, well, then, you know, they must be due for a win. I'm going to bet that they win. When in fact, that individual game, they have exactly the same chance of winning as every other game. Like, we forget that the clock resets for every single game. Like, every single coin flip, even if it's been heads the past 20 times, the odds of it being heads are still 50-50 on the 21st flip. But we think, oh my God, how can it be heads again? I'm going to bet for tails.
Yeah. And then if it happens to be tails, oh gosh, are you a genius?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I used my God brain to figure that out.
So
This episode of Shop Talk Show was brought to you in part by JetpackCRM.com. Like all good business URLs, it's literally just their name, JetpackCRM.com. It's under the Jetpack brand. You know, they've been sponsoring Shop Talk for a while, with Jetpack being the plugin for WordPress that brings WordPress all kinds of more power. This is under that umbrella, but it doesn't like come with the default Jetpack plugin. This is a separate thing that you install, and it's even a la carte priced. So you're not paying for it if you're not already. You can just opt into it. It's a CRM product, you know, like customer relationship management. So that means like putting your customers in there so you can, for example, create invoices for them or quotes for them and just manage the transactions. And when you've talked to them, there's all kinds of tools for, you know, dealing with the people, which is, you know, a fantastic and really required thing if you're doing client work or anything. Or, you know, we might at Shop Talk Show create invoices for the advertisers themselves. Think of that. We might use Jetpack CRM to make an invoice for Jetpack CRM. How's that? Pretty cool. What I like about it is that it's separate, you know, but it's still a plugin for your WordPress site. So you're not learning really. I mean, you're learning how this thing works, but you're doing it in the WordPress world. It's not some additional third-party thing that you have to learn, that you have to manage. And CRMs are notoriously difficult anyway. There's just a lot to them. It's complex software. Really like the idea of bringing it under the WordPress roof. Over the years, every time I've ever done that, brought some functionality that I thought maybe best served by some third-party thing and then rolled it up under my WordPress roof because I had a WordPress site anyway, I have thought that was a fantastic idea. So I think this will be exactly the same. Again, that's jetpackcrm.com. Check it out. Thanks for the sponsorship.
One thing you mentioned in your book was like one defense against being biased or some of these common biases is being like bilingual, because your brain like starts translating. You know, if somebody gives you like a little kind of word puzzle, like I have a baseball and a bat.
Oh, that one. I always get $1 more
than the baseball. How much is the bat or what? And it's like just tricky enough. You're just, you know, your instinct is to say the wrong thing or just do some simple subtraction, but there's a little bit of algebra in there. But like you're saying, if somebody knows two languages, they start translating it like into French. You speak French, but it sort of like breaks up that bias, right?
Yeah, it's slowing down your thinking. So the example I give is, this has to do with the framing effect, where if I were to say, you go to a store and you see a sign for beef that says beef 95% lean, and then you see another sign that says beef 5% fat, like you're motivated to get the 95% lean one, but it's the same thing. It's just been framed in a way where one seems more appealing. And they've done studies where people who speak multiple languages, if they think about that decision in their non-native language, they're less likely to fall for the scam. And for me, I speak a little bit of French, so I'd be like, okay, beef, that's boeuf, that's like 20 vowels. How is that possible? 95%, that's like 89, maybe. I'm trying to, you know. And by the time I've done all of that really thoughtful thinking to do the translation, I've seen right through the scam. And Thinking Fast and Slow is a book by Daniel Kahneman, which is fantastic and is sort of like the Bible of cognitive biases. And the basic idea is that there's these two systems of thinking. One is very fast, and it's the system you use if you want to figure out just by looking at someone's face if they're happy or angry, right? It's very, very quick. Then there's another system you use if you have to answer the question, what's 1,072 times 400? Like, okay, I can't just snap judgment that one, right? Thinking in another language pushes you more toward that system too, that slower way of thinking. And when you're thinking more slowly, you're less likely to do any of these biases, because again, these biases are just shortcuts. There's just these really like simple shortcuts, cutting corners your mind's trying to do because it's busy and it needs to get through the day.
So question. So here's bringing it back to UX or web development, like this whole move fast, break things. Is that, again, a bad, is that,
so, you know? I feel like the move fast, break things, because I was on board with that when it was first kind of introduced. And I think it was introduced, you know, maybe 2008 or so, you had this big entrepreneurial boom because everybody was out of a job and it was just as risky to start a company as it was to try to get a job.
Well, it's easier to say you're an entrepreneur than I'm unemployed.
Yes. Exactly.
Sounds cooler. I'm writing a screenplay.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. So you had this notion of, you had this industry that had become very calcified, right? And you had large organizations that moved very slowly. And as a result, like if I have an idea, right, it's going to take all this planning and all this, you know, motivation to steer the ship, right? And it seemed useless when, you know, some kid in a garage built a prototype in the time it took me to fill out a form asking for permission to have a meeting to maybe do this idea, right? So I think a lot of the move fast and break things thing was sort of just dealing with that frustration of why can't we just do it? Let's just do it. So there's a bias toward action there, which I like, but there are, in fact, the reason that, for example, the scientific community or the medical community doesn't necessarily embrace move fast and break things is because they know that there are consequences and that when things break, quote unquote, they're breaking for people, right? Like they're breaking people.
Yeah.
And I think there's a middle ground where the notion of break things was break things that aren't that aren't going to hurt anybody, because that's a thing. There are things you can break in a controlled environment. Like, again, that's kind of what like clinical trials are and what science does. It's like, hey, let's, you know, test this before we unleash it on the world.
And feature flags, people get on it, you know?
Exactly. I think if you enter into the bias towards action with the spirit of first do no harm, you're in a good place, right? Because yes, I don't want to just go through procedure for the sake of going through procedure. But if those procedures reduce harm, then yes, let's do that. But not, you know, needlessly wait and have 50 meetings before we do that. So I think there's definitely a way to embrace the spirit of move fast and breaking things without hurting people.
Well, that's
never heard that the before. That's awesome.
The Hippocratic Oath, like for like designers, do you think we need something like that?
Ooh, absolutely. Like, I mean, and people are working on this, like. There's a whole list of resources in the back of the book that talk about this, but Mule Design released a little red book of like a designer's code of ethics, which is essentially a Hippocratic Oath. The Design Justice Network has an amazing set of principles that even if you pick one of them and try to adhere to them, you'll be like light years ahead what anyone else is doing. So I think we need it. I think we have the makings of it. I don't know if we want to go into the whole like licensing conversation, because it's fraught, but you want something. You want something that's going to reduce the harm that right now you're basically left to the goodwill of corporations, right? For, you know, it's on Google to say, don't be evil, not because there are consequences if they're evil, because there's not. It's more right. Just, we're just going to choose not to be evil and you better hope you don't change your mind.
Right. So you're saying license in the like certification.
Yeah. Like if you want to practice certified
UX practitioner.
Yeah. And this is like Mike Montero talks about this all the time. I go back and forth, but like whether license is the exact tool for it. But the point it brings up is like, look, people who do dangerous things need a license to do those things. And his argument is design is dangerous because you can point already to any number of bad things that have happened where design played a critical role.
Cigarettes are good for kids. Gives them strong bones. I don't know. I guess that's the next thing, like dark patterns. Cause I was reading the book and I was like, ooh, I could maybe use this for conversions, you know, like, is that how, I guess, like kind of knowing the psychology, having a strong grasp on all these kind of biases, just, you know, are we at risk of exploiting ourselves, you know?
Yeah, and it's tricky too, right? And that's why the book, you know, spoiler alert, the book is actually about design ethics. but that's what it all builds to. The design was unethical all along. No. I think so part of the thing you have to realize, once you acknowledge that design is the act of helping people make decisions, like in a lot of ways. That's very much what our job entails. And you accept the fact that, okay, most people are making their decisions far faster than they can realize they're making them. 95% of the time, they really aren't paying attention. And then third, you accept that your designs are influencing that part, that they're not really paying attention. All of a sudden, as a designer, you have this pretty awesome responsibility because you're kind of sort of reaching in the back of their head and messing around.
Well, yeah, and, right? Like you're reaching into their brain, their lizard, you're manipulating their lizard brain to do stuff.
Yeah, and you're doing that whether you know you're doing it or not. That's the trick. It's not like you have a choice between, okay, am I going to be good or evil? Let me decide whether I want to engage with that question. It's also like, no. Exactly. You're already engaging with it. Like you've already designed something that has either hurt or helped in ways that the user didn't understand. Like that ship has sailed. Now that you know, the question is, what do you do with that knowledge? So I think that's part of it is like, you have to engage. So if it's a question of, I don't want to engage with this because, or I don't want this knowledge because suddenly I can use it for evil. It's like, no. You're already using it. I just want to make you use it better and know what you're doing. Right. And then beyond that, well, I can't tell you whether to be good or evil. Everything in the book is hopefully geared, not just with the assumption that you don't want to be evil, but giving you a framework for not being evil. But more than that, like the reason I talk about ethics and not morality in the book is a lot of people have already talked about morality. There's Technically Wrong by Sarah Wachter Betcher. There's Weapons of Mass Destruction. Like there's a whole corpus of books that are really talking about the morality of this. The reason I come at it from a point of view of ethics is that ethics isn't necessarily there to tell you what is right or wrong. Ethics is there to give you a framework for asking the right questions to arrive at right or wrong. The same way that design isn't, when you go to design school, it isn't necessarily about right or wrong design so much as it is about, here are the questions you need to ask if you are going to do good design, if you're going to do good UX or good content strategy. Here's the set of questions you need to ask. Here's the information that you'll need to gather to then make the right decisions. I'm kind of adding a layer of, and here's the set of questions to ask if you're going to make these decisions in a non-harmful way.
There's a little quip you do after a bias that was just like, marketers take note, because it was about this one particular little thing about a corridor and how the choices that people make at the end of the corridor are, you know, three of their favorite candy or three of different candy. I'll let you read the book to find it out. But the idea is that if you are a marketer, isn't that interesting? Even if you worked for Nike and you wanted to have some new running shoe billboard campaign or something, and there's just, you have to write some copy for that billboard, putting, you know, will you run more this year? ? Might somehow trigger something in somebody's brain better than, you know, this is for runners or something. Yeah. Like posing it as a question may be more effective.
Yeah, it's this bias called reactance. And it's kind of part of the reason we're in the state we are now. But reactance is basically the you can't tell me what to do bias. And I'll just tell you the quarter example. So the easy example is has to do with graffiti. So if you have like, they've done this where they like take one wall and they put a sign on the wall that says, please do not write on this wall. And then they have another wall that says, under no circumstances should you write on this wall. Guess which wall got the most graffiti, right? And especially Americans, you don't tell us what to do, right? Like, don't.
What? Don't. Why is America especially bad at
that? Okay, America's especially bad at that because, and this is my theory, but because we were made up of the people, if excepting slaves who had no choice, but we were made up of the people who said, rather than stay in a country that is limiting my freedom, I'm going to take my toys and go somewhere else. Right. Versus people who stayed and said, okay, this sucks, but I'm going to live with it or try to change it from within. Right. So we are especially the people who are like, no, King, you can't tell me what to do. I'm going to go somewhere else. Or no, you can't tell me that Puritanism isn't allowed. I'm going to go somewhere else. Right.
Okay.
Versus so the folks who are like, okay, I guess I can't be a Puritan. You know? So that I think is especially, but in general, people don't like being told what to do.
People don't like it. It's just like their reaction to it, like a scale of 1 to 10.
Exactly.
I mean, I think we're seeing 10s across the board on the news.
I mean, the mask thing, right? Like part of the reason, there's certainly a political dimension, but part of the reason that people are being so, let's say, overly like reactive to the notion of wearing a mask is this notion of, well, you can't tell me what to do. Right.
Whereas like in Japan, I lived in Japan and it was, you know, 10, 20 years ago now, but it was, it's like people get sick, they just wear a mask.
Yeah.
It's just like normal. They sell it at the friggin' convenience store and like, it's just normal. And then people like, kind of like, why aren't you wearing a mask? You sound sick, you know? And you're like, oh, maybe I should be wearing a mask, you know? But here it's like, well, shoot, I'm going to drive my motorcycle into your business. You can't tell me not to wear a mask. I don't know. I don't get it. I don't know.
Yeah.
I always get back to like, why is America so extreme on this?
Yeah. And it's because, I mean, I hate to bring everything back to capitalism, but like there's a great like argument that keeps coming up around, you remember when people say like, oh, we can send a person to the moon, but we can't feed the homeless, or America's the richest country in the world, but we have one of the worst rates when it comes to coronavirus. Like, how can that be? And I think it's based on this bias that money equals competence, right? Or money equals reach. That because we have enough money to do a thing.
Halo
effect. Yeah. If we have enough money to do a thing, we would do it. And what I think people miss, and again, this is my own theory, but what I think people miss is that the reason we're the richest country in the world. Oh, there's a slip of the tongue. The reason we're the richest country in the world is precisely because we can't feed our poor. Like, it's the same thing. Like, the reason we were able to get as rich as we could is by ignoring a lot of big social problems. Like, you can get a lot done when you have free labor. You can get a lot done when you don't provide a social safety net. You can accumulate amazing amounts of wealth when you ignore certain things. So it's not a because thing. It's because it's that's why we're so rich. It's because we don't have an infrastructure for dealing with coronavirus. That's expensive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Don't give me, that would cost hundreds of dollars. It'd be terrible. That makes sense, I guess. Yeah. Like the kind of our best friend is also our biggest, I don't know, like we don't plan ahead in that sense.
Yeah. And to get back to the reactants thing, right? So the idea then is that, so we hate being told what to do, and it's so, like, particular, like, there's an experiment where you have a hallway, and at the end of the hallway is a table with a whole bunch of candy. And the experiment is you walk down the hallway and you tell the person, when you get to the end of the hallway, take three pieces of candy, any candy you want. And usually people will just pick three of their favorite candy. And there's lots of different kinds of candy there, but they'll pick three of their favorite and say, thanks. That's the control group. The other group is given this weirdly narrow hallway to walk down. And when they get to the end of that hallway, they are more likely to pick three different pieces of candy. And the theory is that that weirdly narrow hallway makes them feel constricted, like their choices are being taken away. So when they get to the end of the hallway, they will show that they still have independence by, damn it, picking three pieces of candy. I don't care what, three different kinds of candy, no matter what, right? So it is so like easy to prime in us, right? And the marketer thing is really just saying that it's so extreme that even we can't tell ourselves what to do. So if you have people, I think it's they write down either I will exercise today versus will I exercise today? And write it 20 times. And the ones who write will I exercise today as a question are more likely to then actually exercise or eat healthier, whatever it is. And the idea is that if you write down I will exercise, you're telling your future self what to do. If you write down, will I exercise, you're giving your future self options. So even you can't tell you what to do. And that's where it's like, hey, marketers, if you want people to do stuff, like give them more options, not less.
Yeah. Yeah. That's wild. So, you know, Dave brought up Dark Patterns a little bit, which is like a company that might otherwise be somewhat reputable, dips their toes into bad things like, I don't know, you got a call to cancel and crap like that. I mean, there's a million Dark Patterns, but then there's a level beyond that, which is just straight up, you know, bad people on the internet that are trying to, I don't know, get your passwords and fish you and spam you or
take money from kids, like micro.
Yeah, sell you some weird pill or something that they're not even going to ship you. I wonder if that is there. Have you ever looked into that? Like the bad people of the internet exploiting biases? I suppose that's.
I mean, that's. Yeah. I mean, and that's like. I don't cover that really just because it's almost like table stakes. It's like, I think we know that. And I think it's worth noting that, yeah, they are taking advantage of very specific biases, like to get you to do things. A lot of what scammers use, and this is an old technique, this is like not new, is this notion that when you are stressed, when you are afraid, when you are, when there's a sense of urgency, you do stupid stuff. It's easy to get you to do something. And they've done, again, experiments where it's like, you like have someone who has to like fill out a form on a computer or something like that, and you put them in a sort of stressful situation, they fill it out faster and they fill it out like without very little regard for like what they're actually filling out. And so if I call you and say, hey, you know, your credit card identity has been stolen. Can you please confirm your identity? I need the last four numbers of your social security number. This person's like racking up all the, like immediately you're put in mind of like, oh my God, if I don't do this right now, every second I waste, I'm losing money, right? If I can get you into that state, right, then I am much more likely to be able to get information from you than if I call you up and say like, no big deal. Yeah, your identity has been stolen, but we've frozen all your credit cards. So everything's cool. Can you give me your like social security number? It's like, well, why am I doing that? Everything's fine.
Yeah. So they put you in a bottled, whatever pressure situation.
Yeah. And again, it's to get you to think too quickly. That's where bias comes in. Like I'm thinking too quickly. Therefore I am making mistakes.
Aye.
Wow. This is all fascinating. I love this topic. It feels like the intersection of, I don't know, pop science and design and stuff. And so this is just a very cool topic.
Yeah, no wonder you got so into it. And I'm glad you've been able to turn it into a little career-ish for you. You know, I mean, now it is officially because you have the book out. So I hope it sells a zillion copies, you know, but then you... I don't know, but don't be too capitalistic.
Yeah, and it's like the capitalist angle, honestly, and I don't go into this too much in the book, except to really think about, there's a middle section of the book that talks about moral hazard of gameplay, which is this idea of like, what are you incentivizing versus what is your goal actually? And you do see where like if you focus on the money, it's very easy to run into some very bad places. But if you focus on like the good, then you can still, like, money's still a part of the equation. It's just a question of what you're doing with it. Like, what you're doing with it becomes the goal versus the money itself. I think that's the difference if you want to paint with a very broad brush between good, quote-unquote, capitalism and bad, quote-unquote, capitalism is the capital. Like, is the end of the capital, or is the end you have a society of people who are healthy and not trying to kill each other?
I think that they said that in Weapons of Math Destruction, I think, and that was the first time I'd heard it, like, money as the incentive it creates a bad system because you're like, well, I'll just keep making the money go up. And in my brain, I'm like, aren't you just supposed to make the money go up? That's like how I've been living my whole life. But yeah, the sort of other side of it is like, you have to look at these other factors. You know, I think of it as like, you can't just measure your shoe size and be like, buy all your clothes based on your shoe size. You have to like... take other measurements to get all the clothes that would fit.
Guys with big feet. I got an email about it just this morning.
Yeah. I have no idea, but I just, I'm 10 and a half. What does that do? So what does, I guess, like, I don't know. What's like the big takeaway? What do you want people to do? Do you want people to like, reject their own brains? Do you want people to acknowledge their own brains? Do you want people to I don't know, just rethink everything? What's your big goal?
What I want people to do is to lean on each other and to lean on folks that they're not used to leaning on. Because at the end of the day, the sort of surest route to unbiasing something, so to speak, is to introduce new biases. Because like I said, you're not going to get rid of the bias overnight. That's going to take a very long time, but people need help today. So what can you do? You can invite people to the table when you're making a decision, when you're creating a design, when you're creating an app, when you're creating a product, who are not like you. Ideally, people who are going to be impacted by that design. And you can put into place, and when I say put into place, I mean put it in the budget, do it. Make it part of the estimating session, make it part of the project plan, right? Because if it doesn't exist in the budget, it doesn't exist. But put it in there, certain procedures, like at the beginning of a project saying, okay, who's the project team? Okay, what identities are they bringing to the table? How is that going to impact the work? Who isn't represented here? Okay, how is that absence going to impact the work? Okay, what can we do to make sure that that doesn't impact the work poorly? And not just think about, oh, we're going to interview the users, we're going to interview the stakeholders. Well, is there anyone who's going to be impacted by this thing you're building? who aren't the users and who aren't the stakeholders. Okay, let's interview them too, right? So that is another level that you can bring to it. But I think the very concrete goal is I want to see red team, blue team, and this sort of identity discussion like start to appear on people's project plans and people's budgets, right? Like to me, that is a very tangible process because then it's the same as saying, hey, 10, 20 years ago, doing an accessibility QA or even having that word in your SOW wasn't a thing. It just wasn't. Right. Mm-hmm. And through lots and lots of things, including legislation, we're at a point now where, like, I don't know about you, but my company, like, all of our SOWs have AA compliance. Like, that's not negotiable. Like, even if you ask for single A compliance, it's like, I don't care. We're giving you AA compliance. Mm-hmm. Right. I work at a think company, it's an experience design firm. And we're like, yeah, like, when we're doing our pitches, it's like, sorry, it has to be AA. Like, that's just how we roll. Right. 20 years ago, people double A what now? Right? Like so that's the arc I see inclusive design taking of saying, okay, right now people like red team, blue team, what? And I want to get to a point, or participatory design, what? Or people who are impacted, what? I want it to be to the point where it's like, oh no, as part of our SOW, when we research, we also look at who's going to be impacted by the thing we're building. Like that's just table stakes. Yeah. Like why would you not do that? Like I'm not saying my book gets us there. I'm saying I hope my book starts that conversation.
You know, that's good. I wanted to build like a shed in my backyard. I had to pay $500 to get a survey about my trees. You know, like maybe it's that simple. You just get a survey like, okay, you're doing what now? Okay, that's actually terrible for minority communities. Or like, you know, maybe it's just that simple or something. I don't know.
Yeah, and again, it's not like we're fumbling around in the dark here. The study of ethics has been around for 2,000 years. Folks like the IRB, which is a board that reviews any research a medical professional scientist wants to do, and they do look at things like injustice, inequality, like are you looking at the impact on vulnerable communities? Like they look at that stuff. Like if you want to do a study, they got to say it's okay. That's one way to do it, right? And that's one model. But at the end of the day, like I don't care particularly which route we go or routes plural we go to get to more ethical, less harmful design. But I do want us to agree that the goal is less harmful, more ethical design, and then start taking steps to get there.
Cool. That's great. Well, that's a wonderful place probably to.
I heard Facebook's going to lead the charge.
Yeah. You know what? Mark's got this. I think we can trust Mark. Let's just.
Zuck is setting up a Bitcoin to get us to get there.
If we can't trust Mark, who can we trust? I mean, come on.
You know, I said it on the last show. I can't figure out which multi-billion-dollar company to trust anymore. You know, it's getting hard out there. Well, thank you, Dave, for coming on the show. For people who aren't following you, giving you money, how can they do that?
Sure. So honestly, if you go to daviddylanthomas.com, you can get a link to buy my book there. You can get a link to see if I can come out and give a talk where you are or a workshop. You can just email me and say, hey, let's chat. All of that is at daviddylanthomas.com. So just head over there.
And you gave a talk at Artifact Conf last year. It was one of the best talks I'd seen all year. So
thank you.
I can thumbs up that talk. So, all right. Well, thank you. And we'll just wrap up the show. Thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcatcher choice. Be sure to star heart favorite up. That's how people find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at Shop Talk Show, tens of tweets a month. And if you hate your job, head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one because people want to hire people like you, even in this economy. And Chris, did you have anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.